step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. There was a time when New York City was dying a fast death. The slums were war zones, the government bankrupt and sputtering. Mobsters disassembled one another nightly and dropped hefty bags of mixed parts off the Carnegie Pier. Gangs rumbled in the city's playgrounds and ghost towns, each battle busted up by the sound of gunfire or police siren. Co-eds were raped and sent home shattered. Wide swaths of real estate, former ghettos, were abandoned and left to the squatters. Times Square, once seemingly the center of the universe, had sunk into an odorous septic tank. A choice of porn loops in a booth of somnolent live sex shows continuous. New York had crumbled into a city of ancient runes when city-tough blades of sharp brass poked through each crack in the pavement, a city undergoing a so-called fiscal crisis, but more a crisis of the soul, a city of routine muggings, vacant lots turned dump site, pocked and abandoned roads to nowhere, a city that President Gerald Ford told to drop dead, a city in which four murders a night was the norm, a city of scary shadows, vacant lots, sewer gas from a cracked manhole, a stinging rain of rust from tenement fire escapes, where pedestrians routinely dodged bell-bottom angel dust time bombs, where young savage baby boomers washed down black beauties with Rheingold out of a can, where each glance into the shadows was an assault upon civilized sensibilities, a derelict Big Apple, rotten at the core, with no signs of hope. In the South Bronx, 10 square blocks per year, 5,000 housing units were lost to arson. Owners abandoned properties rather than pay the tax, often torching them at night to collect insurance, leaving block after block of charred hulks. Ford Apache, they called it after the old Western movie, where it looked like the bomb had gone off. Nothing but steamy brick streets and smoldering rubble. It was a ghost town inhabited only by clownishly uniformed soldiers of vague cause who moved like insects, who fought for worthless turf and pride and dignity through the smoke of despair. And for a year, scariest of all, it was the city of Son of Sam, a terrifying specter of sadism and ritualistic blood sacrifice. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Wicked King Wicker, The Son of Sam's Siege Upon New York, with my special guest journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Michael Benson.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much, Michael. Did this incredible introduction that you've written so eloquently. Tell us a little bit more about, before we start, about the siege that Son of Sam put upon New York City. just tell us where New York City was in 1976.
Well, you know, not only was the Son of Sam the most infamous serial murder case in New York history, but it happened against a backdrop of a city that seemed to be at death's door. New York was in bad shape. It was kind of a smoldering ruins. I'm not really an expert in why it was that way, but it did come back. You know, it recovered. But in 1976 and 77, it was a place to leave. And I know because I was going to school at the time on Long Island, and I used to go into the city all the time. And a lot of times it was just terrifying. You're afraid to go down a street for fear that somebody would jump you. Crime was out of control. Part of it, I think, had to do with the fact that the baby boomer generation was in its late teens and early 20s at that time. So people, when they're at the rowdiest and most apt to commit crimes, were plentiful. Also, the mafia was having wars. They were knocking each other off every night. There was gunfire in the streets. And considering the fact that between July of 1976 and July of 1977, there were maybe 1,500 murders in New York City, the Son of Sam committed 6 murders, wounded 7 in 8 attacks. And yet, the Son of Sam, and I will, sometimes refer to him as he, although it's a they, was on the front pages of the newspapers for much of that time. And that's because, although there were many places in New York City that were considered to be highly dangerous at that time, the Son of Sam attacks occurred only in the pockets of perceived safety. Son of Sam made everyone, even the beautiful kids of successful parents, feel like targets. And kids who were used to doing pretty much what they pleased, when they pleased, all of a sudden realized that the boogeyman was real and he was going to get them if they didn't look out. I've always felt a close association with these crimes. I went to Hofstra University at that time. I was only 6 miles away from the closest Son of Sam shooting in Floral Park. And for the kids my age in New York City, the summer of 1977 was a wasted summer. Everyone in the Bronx and Queens and later in Brooklyn were afraid to go out because there was a psycho out there shooting kids.
Now, before, I know there was so much trouble in New York, but teenagers feel invincible. So, and then they carry on with their lives despite the crises and havoc and chaos of the streets and the city that they lived in. On July 29th, 1976, teenagers Donna Loria and her friend Jody Valenti, 19, Donna was 18, they had gone out dancing. And they were in they had borrowed Jody's car. Tell us a little bit about what happens in the car at the end of this evening on Bure Avenue.
Well, yeah, they're parked outside Donna's apartment building. Jody lives right around the corner. And they're coming home after a night of dancing at a discotheque up in Westchester County, where it's safe. And they're in the Westchester Heights, Pelham Bay section of the Bronx, where it's safe. And they're just having a little chat, listening to the radio before Donna goes home. And Donna's dad is on his way down the stairs with their dog. He's going to take the dog for a walk. No problem, because the streets are safe in that section. And Donna opens the door to go in, and she sees a man approaching. She goes, oh, what the heck is this? And she slams the door and gets back inside the car. And then a gunman fires 4 shots through the passenger side window, strikes Donna in the right temple, killing her instantly, and shoots Jody in the thigh. Jody gets out of the car and starts screaming. She opens the passenger side door, and Donna falls out of the car. And this happens just as Donna's dad emerges from the front door of the apartment building, and he immediately recognizes what he's seeing and bursts into tears. Jody describes the shooter as 5'9", about 160 pounds, with curly black hair, clean shaven, fair complexion, wearing a white striped polo shirt, black or dark pants, could not have looked any more regular or less scary, but he had a scary gun. Now, police come, and they, because Donna and Jody are Italian girls,
yeah,
they assume that this is part of a mafia vendetta, and that just really steamed Donna's dad because it has nothing to do with organized crime.
That's right.
Profiling at its worst. And the most unusual thing about the murder is that, unlike the pocket guns that mobsters use, the bullets are .44 caliber, and that is very rare.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was also...
Let me throw something in here. About a year before that, there was another series of crimes up in Westchester County in which somebody was using an air gun to fire steel-tipped, feather-ended darts through ground floor windows at women. And he was aiming high, maybe for the eyes, and there were women wounded in many towns in Westchester, including Yonkers, New York. And experts said that the shooter was probably a peeping Tom, a voyeur, who was taking his sickness to the next level. They called him Dart Man. And it's interesting here because soon after the Dart Man attacks stop, the Son of Sam attacks begin.
You write about that there was a composite developed from this eyewitness account. You mentioned the 5'9", 160 pounds. And then right. October 4th, 1976, there's a Molotov cocktail thrown through the window of the Carr family home. Tell us about
right.
this event.
Well, at the time, there is no way to make a connection between the two things. But
right.
there is, in Yonkers, in a stretch of streets that include Wicker Street and Warburton Street, the home of Sam Carr, who has three kids, John, Michael, and Wheat, and somebody throws a Molotov cocktail at their house. Time the fire department arrives, Sam's put the fire out. Not a major deal, but it's the first indication that the Carr family is the subject of some kind of psycho out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's another house is also there's an attempted arson later on. An apartment in a large apartment building in Yonkers has a fire started just outside the door. So there's a firebug going on. And also, you know, somebody's out there shooting dogs. So there's trouble in Yonkers, and there are weird attacks starting up in New York, but nobody's going to make that connection for quite a while yet.
As you do, to October 23rd, shortly after, 1976, and Carl DeNaro. And,
yes.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
This is the attack that is talked about the least. You know, it's not the first one, and nobody's killed, and the wounded person is male. So journalists didn't quite pick up on it the way they did the others. But it was, 2:30 a.m., October 23rd, 1976, Carl DeNaro and Rosemary Keenan. They're not boyfriend and girlfriend, but they had gotten together at a bar earlier in the night. Carl had just enlisted, and he had long brown hair. Rosemary is the daughter of a police detective. And they're sitting in a Volkswagen Beetle parked on a residential street in the Murray Hill section of Queens, sometimes referred to as easternmost Flushing, but I think it's Murray Hill. Rosemary, for reasons that probably don't matter to us, is sitting behind the wheel. And Carl is in the passenger seat, even though he's the one who borrowed the car. And at 2:30 a.m., passenger side window explodes. and Carl is shot in the head. Rosemary is unharmed. She manages to get the car in gear despite, you know, must have been panic, and drives back to the bar that the two had just left. And Carl's taken to Flushing Hospital, where he has to stay for a month. They put a plate in his head, and the bullets are .44 caliber. Nobody makes any connection between this attack and the one in the Bronx. They're miles apart.
Right.
And the person who takes the most interest, of course, is Detective Red Keenan, whose daughter was in a car that was shot at. And, you know, yeah. Nobody's saying anything about the mafia this time. But later on, it would be assumed that the shooter, at dark at night, when a fellow with long, dark hair, thought that he was shooting a girl when he was shooting a guy.
Right.
But, Carl's still around, and he's a good guy. But he never did get to serve in the military because he was shot in the head instead. That's just a bad luck. And he never got together with Rosemary, even though they were sort of hitting it off that night.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write about 4 weeks later in Queens, November 27th, Joanne Lomino and Donna DeMasi. Joanne's 18 and DeMasi is 16, and they go to a movie and they're taking a bus home, and then they spot a creepy-looking guy. Tell us about this.
Well, they're so far out in Queens that it's a block and a half away from the Nassau County border. It's just barely inside New York City, and you have to go to the end of the subway and then catch a bus to their neighborhood. Floral Park. It's close to where Belmont Park is, where they hold the Belmont Stakes horse race. And it's November 27th. It is Thanksgiving weekend. You know, I say that, I was only 6 miles away at the time, but I probably wasn't. I was probably up in Rochester home for the holiday.
Right.
And they got back from the movies, and they're walking from the bus stop, and they see a man hiding behind a telephone pole, which is both terrifying and ridiculous because you can see him sticking out the sides. It's almost comical, but why is that the bizarre behavior? And that translates into fear. So the girls hurry home, and they are right in front of Joanne's house when they see the guy walking on the other side of the street, and he's slender. He's a skinny guy, 150 pounds, soaking wet, 5'8", with dirty blonde hair, long, parted on the side. And older, he's between 25 and 30 years old. Not a kid, this is a man.
Mm-hmm.
Wearing a brown three-quarter length coat over what appears to be army fatigues. Now, they stop in front of the house, and Joanne doesn't want to go in because she doesn't want the guy to know where she lives. So they're pausing there in front of the house, and he crosses the street, and he starts to say something which they interpret as, "Do you know where?" And then he starts to mumble. They back away from him, and they're now up on the porch of Joanne's house when he pulls a gun and fires wildly. He hits them both, but one shot hits the house. It's a bizarre miss. And a .44 has quite a kick, so it's not unusual for it to be less than accurate. But, mm-hmm. I mean, horrible things. You know, Donna's shot in the neck, and Joanne is shot in the spine and is paralyzed from the waist down to this day.
Right.
The shooter is seen fleeing, holding a gun in his left hand. Again, eyewitness says long, light-colored hair, and 44 shell casings are found at the crime scene. So police are starting to make the connection now that perhaps these are connected shootings, but they haven't released any information to that effect to the public yet. After the next shooting, that's when there would really be no holding it back anymore.
Yeah, let's talk about Christine Freund, January 30th, 1977. 12:30 a.m. And she's parked, again, similarly, she's parked with a boyfriend, John Deal. He's 30 years old. And sadly, they're planning to be engaged February 14th, Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Tell us about this incident.
Yeah, these aren't kids. These are young adults. Christine is a Wall Street secretary. John's 30 years old. They've been together for years and years. They've had their ups and downs in their relationship. They're in a 1976 blue Pontiac Firebird, and they're parked in a little plaza, fairly well lit, underneath the Long Island Railroad Station. And it's in Forest Hills, Queens, which at that time was known mostly for being the site of the U.S. Open tennis tournament, away in this almost a fairyland neighborhood, all these Tudor-style homes, and tiny, curving, skinny roads. And so they couldn't have felt more safe. And they'd just been to a wine and cheese place, and they're warming up the car before heading home. And a shooter approaches and fires through the passenger side window. Fires three times. Christine is struck twice, first in the shoulder, and then, just as she let out a short scream, in the head. A third bullet ricochets off the windshield, and John Deal is uninjured. You know, for what seems to him forever, but probably is only a matter of seconds, he tries to keep her sitting up in the seat because he thinks that that will help. And every time he lets go of her, she falls over into his lap. He, you know, pushes her back up, and she falls into his lap again. Eventually, he realizes this is not doing any good. He gets out of the car and starts to scream for help. And he sees a man standing there, staring at him, seemingly relaxed. He says, "Help me, help me." And the man just turns around slowly and walks away. And John runs around the neighborhood, you know, chicken with his head cut off, and screaming for help. He's diving on the hood of cars. And nobody is stopping. Nobody wants to get involved. Eventually, somebody inside a house hears the ruckus and calls for the police. And the police show up, and it's not that much time has gone by, but you know, to John, it just seems forever. He's been all around the neighborhood. And Captain Joseph Borelli, who's chief of the Queens Homicide Squad, shows up and he finds a slug at the scene that's only slightly deformed. And from this piece of metal, they could not just determine that the gun was a .44, but that it was a Charter Arms Bulldog .44, a fact that was not immediately released to the public. Now, the Bulldog .44 is pretty rare. At that time, there were only 56 of them registered in the New York metropolitan area, and they were designed for a specific purpose. I don't know if you remember, but back in those days, there was a problem with skyjackings.
Right.
People were hijacking commercial airplanes and having them fly to Cuba. So the gun was designed to shoot a hijacker without piercing the fuselage of the plane. So the bullet lost speed, muzzle velocity, very quickly, and was wildly inaccurate at anything, you know, more than 5 feet. So now they know the weapon that's doing these shootings, but again, they don't inform the public. They wait for one more shooting place. A few weeks later, in March 8th, 1977, but only about 100 yards away. And this one's different. It's 7:30 in the evening on a Tuesday night. It's not a weekend. It's not the middle of the night. The sun has just set. It's recently dark. And it's right around the corner from where Christine was murdered in the previous attack. Now, I've walked this. I've gotten out of the subway where the victim got out and walked it. You walk right by where Christine was shot, it's through the well-lighted plaza underneath the railroad station, and then you take a right-hand turn onto Dartmouth Street, and it is pitch black. And I can still remember the start of turning that corner and realizing that my eyes were going to have to to dilate before I was going to be able to see anything at all. And that's what Virginia Vascarichian had just done. And she was a college girl, 20 years old. And she lived in Forest Hills, you know, one of the prettiest and most beautiful and certainly considered the safest neighborhood in all of New York City. And as she was walking down Dartmouth Street, a small person, gender uncertain, thought, you know, later described as a teenage boy, but possibly a girl, walks right up to Virginia, sticks the gun at her. Virginia, who's carrying books because she's coming home from school, puts the books over her face. The shooter presses the gun against the books and pulls the trigger. One shot only. Through the books and through Virginia's mouth and, unfortunately, you know, through her brain lodging near her spine. And she falls down across the sidewalk with her head awkwardly angled in a clump of bushes in front of 4 Dartmouth Street. And there are multiple witnesses. This is not a deserted area. It's 7:30 in the evening. And 2 distinctly different suspects are seen fleeing. And one is the young teenage boy or girl in a dark ski cap, 16 to 18 years old estimate, fleeing the scene, running west. And running in the other direction is a white adult male, 25 to 30 years old, clean shaven, clear skin, medium build, 5'10 to 6 foot, well-groomed, with dark hair combed straight back, which resembles the man seen at the first shooting
right
by Jody Valenti. Now, after this, there's really no secrets from the public anymore. The 2 shootings, you know, in closeness in time and geography, and really, I thought, so I pasted off. They're 100 yards apart. And on Thursday, March 10th, Mayor Abraham Beame, who's, you know, the mayor of this sinking ship called New York City, and Police Commissioner Michael Codd decide they have to inform the public about what's going on. They hold a press conference at the Forest Hills Precinct Station, and they announce that the man who killed Virginia also killed Christine and also killed Donna Loria in the Bronx the previous summer. They said that the weapon was a Charter Arms Bulldog 44, and if anybody knew anyone who had such a weapon, please let them know. And then they did something that still strikes me as odd, because New York City does not have as many blonde people as the rest of the country, or Canada, I suppose. We are a dark-haired people, and we tend to be ethnic in New York. But they said that the killer seems to prefer girls with long, dark hair, and that the male victim also had long, dark hair and was sitting in the passenger seat and probably was mistaken for a girl. Now, this is the first furor. This is just the beginning of the real craze. It's a 44 killer, he's known as. He's going to be on the front page from now on, and beauty parlors are doing unbelievable business because every young woman in New York is getting her hair cut and having it dyed blonde. As it turns out, you know, as we now know, Son of Sam didn't care what color your hair was.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop. Sorry, excuse me. Let's stop for a second for these messages.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office.
More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You talked about... Sorry. Pardon me for that. You talked about Captain Borelli and Detective Gallagher, and now they're doing everything in their power to try to assemble a team and also create a psychological profile and do everything they can to calm the public now that they have released certain information regarding this perpetrator. So what's the next step in terms of determining anything more about the suspect? It looks like they have descriptions from about two different suspects with colored hair and size. And so what do they do with that information?
Well, you would think that's what they would think, but that's not the way they look at it. And to be fair, it is often difficult after a shooting to determine the difference between eyewitnesses who are fleeing and the killer. I mean, unless you actually see the gun in their hand, they look the same. They're trying to get the heck away from there. I know I wrote about the whacking of Albert Anastasia in a barber shop in New York City. And the only way they could tell who the shooters from the other people in the barber shop who were trying to get away was which ones had the shaving cream on their face.
Mm-hmm.
So they're thinking that the adult man with the dark hair is the shooter, and the shorter teenager is probably an eyewitness who's just trying to get away.
Right.
It's part of consolidated thinking. You know, that they have one gun, there's one shooter. And the thought that this may be a pack of creepy kids, I mean, it doesn't occur to it occurs to them. And certainly, you know, Detective Marlon Hopkins, you know, says it out loud. Says, you know, this might be a bunch of kids passing a gun around. But that kind of thinking is not encouraged because it tends to open doors when police like to close doors.
You talk about this new task force, Omega Group, headed by Inspector Timothy Dowd.
Right.
And this is Joe Borelli's new boss. So what was this new approach with this team that they assemble called Omega Group?
Well, they set what they thought were traps. I mean, especially after the next shooting in which the Son of Sam returns to a neighborhood for the second time, they have geographical hotspots. And the second there's a shooting, the first cop to hear about it goes, you know, code 44, at which point the traps would close up. There would be roadblocks. There would be shutting down of the bridges. The idea is to trap the killer geographically and then close in on him. And, you know, as we now know, it never works. And,
right.
I mean, it becomes the next shooting, we have two police officers who are watching the building in Pelham Bay section of the Bronx where Donna Laurie was killed the previous July, and the shooting is around the corner on Hutchinson River Parkway. More than 100 yards, but I bet you no more than 500 yards.
Incredible.
And it's only one turn, and again, I've walked it, and they were that close. Still didn't catch the guy. So, I mean, it was very frustrating. And then it's just eating cops alive. There is just 44 fatigue is already setting in. Guys aren't sleeping. I mean, detectives hate these kind of cases. The victims don't deserve to be shot. You know, there's a certain comfort in covering, like, mob cases where, you know, a mobster from one family shoots a mobster from another family. Well, it's, as long as there's no collateral damage, mm-hmm. we'll still try to figure out who's doing it, but we'll sleep at night. But, I mean, poor Joanne Lomino, who's in a wheelchair, trying to deal with the dad of Donna Loria, who's, in her grave, and trying to apologize to her dad for thinking it was a mob thing, when now they realize it's a psycho killer thing. But, things then changed drastically in 1977 when the killer returns to the Bronx.
With Valentina Suriani, 18, and Alexander Isal, he's a 20-year-old. And they're sitting in a car as well, and they're supposed to go to a movie that evening. And like you say, this is a couple blocks from where Donna Loria was killed. So tell us about this evening and its attack.
We don't know what they did, because this time the shooting is deadly accurate. It's 3 a.m. It's exactly a week after Easter. They're sitting in a borrowed maroon-colored Mercury Montego beside a screen fence, the service road that runs along the expressway. And Valentina's behind the wheel. The windows are all rolled up. It's a mild spring night, like jacket weather. Killer approaches from the driver's side of the car and shoots through the driver's side window. Valentina's struck in the mouth, a bullet that went through her neck. It exited behind her right ear. Another bullet hit her behind her left ear and went through her brain and came to a rest against the inside of her skull near the base of her neck. She's killed instantly. Alexander is shot twice in the top of his head, and he's rendered unconscious by the shots, but he somehow clings to life. A neighbor recognizes the sound of gunfire and calls police. Alexander's rushed to the hospital, and he dies a few hours later. And we know that they planned to go to a movie and they planned to do this, but we really don't know, because there are no witnesses. But as they're investigating the crime scene on Hutchison Park, Hutchison River Parkway, open the car door and an envelope falls out into the street. And inside the envelope is a letter, and it's addressed to Captain Joseph Borelli. And it starts like this. I am deeply hurt by your calling me a Wemon hater. That's W-E-M-O-N. It's woman misspelled to rhyme with demon. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Well, that's how it starts. And it continues in its creepy way. And the writer refers to himself in a number of ways. His little brat, son of Sam, Beelzebub, Mr. Monster, Chubby Behemoth. But the one that sticks, as we all know now, is son of Sam. And the letter ends, I'll be back, I'll be back. Bang, 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 bang. Yours in murder, Mr. Monster. Now
what does Detective Borello do in terms of response? It goes to the newspaper. Decide to do?
Okay, well, we want to help you. We understand you're sick. We know you don't hate women. And I read the response in the newspaper, and I can just imagine, the shooter's reaction to this. It seemed very insincere. Cops are not your friend, especially if you're a serial killer. But that was the route they took, And then things got worse because a couple of days later, Jimmy Breslin, who is the columnist for the New York Daily News, he gets a letter also, you know, from, quote, Son of Sam, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, you know, as a lifelong writer, I just got to say, it's really well written. If you took it out of context, you could pass it off as a poem by Allen Ginsberg or you know, lyrics by Bob Dylan or something, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And again, mm-hmm. let me just read the beginning of it for you.
Yeah.
It starts out, "Hello from the gutters of New York City, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of New York City, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of New York City, and from the ants dwell in these cracks and feed in the dried blood of the dead that has settled into the cracks." Now again, the writer gives a series of things that he may be called, and mm-hmm. they sort of, it's almost a list. There's Sam's Creation 44, The Duke of Death, title of this book, The Wicked King Wicker, mm-hmm. The 22 Disciples of Hell, which turns out to be a real thing, John Wheaties, Rapist and Suffocator of Young Girls, who turns out to be a real person. And then the on the back of the envelope, there's like a little haiku. And it goes, "Blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity." Now, holy cow. I mean, this letter, because it's sent to a journalist, gets printed, you know, in its entirety in the newspaper. And that's it. It's just it.
Yeah.
Everybody is terrified. Kids stop going out, especially kids in the Bronx and Queens. And the, you know, there are still blondes who are saying, "Well, he doesn't like my type. That's okay." But it's a city where the economy is already hanging on by a thread, and now nobody's going out at night. You know, the places right. that were doing okay business, you know, in the outer areas of the city, the discotheques and the bars, they're empty. You know, nobody's going out. They're offering specials. They're offering valet parking. If you're a woman and you want to go out, we're never going to allow you to be alone. You know, you don't have to walk from the parking lot to the bar. You'll be escorted. So, it's amazing. And so by the time the next shooting, we have a poor teenage girl who has just graduated from high school. She's got friends and relatives over to her house after the graduation ceremony who are afraid to go out. And she says, "Well, you know, darn you all, I'm going to go out because I just graduated and I'm going to party." And mm-hmm. they said, "Don't do it. You know, the Son of Sam's out there." She said, "Oh, well, you know, I'll go to a place I'm familiar with, you know, a place that says they're going to keep me safe." But she didn't stay safe.
You talk about Sal Lupo and Judy Placido.
Yeah. Yeah, Judy. Judy's the girl I was just discussing. Sal Lupo is a fellow who's hanging out at the Eliphas Disco in Bayside. Now, after school, I moved into an apartment in Bayside. It was only about two blocks away from this scene, so it was the first Son of Sam scene that I ever investigated and walked off. I've done them all now, but only a couple of years after it happened, I was all over it. And the kids had met once before at the Eliphas, and she went there because she felt safe, and Sal was there, and she trusted Sal. Sal said, "Hey, you know, don't worry about it. I'll give you a ride home. You're good with me." And it's 3:10 a.m. He borrows the keys from the bouncer of the club. The guy drives a Cadillac, and takes her to the car, you know, to smooch and make out a little bit before she goes home. And because he's unfamiliar with the car, he has to turn on the inside light to find the cigarette lighter. It's only on for a second, but they later think that's probably when they were spotted by the shooter, who creeps up on the car unnoticed and fires four shots in quick succession through the passenger side window. The first shot strikes Judy in the neck. The second grazes Judy in the head and fails to penetrate her skull, thank heavens, stopped behind her eyebrow. And the third shot struck Sal in the wrist and ended up embedded in the front seat cushion. Now, Sal's aware of pain in his arm, and Judy's making little whimpering noises in her throat. So Sal runs back to the club, which is a block and a half away, and Judy manages to get out of the car. Amazingly, she manages to get out of the car and stagger down the street. It's a light rain. She's staggering down the street screaming before she collapses in the middle of the street. And Sal and Judy are taken by ambulance to Flushing Hospital, where both are listed in fair condition. And one witness sees a stocky white male running south from the scene along 211th Street. A second witness sees a well-dressed blonde with a mustache get into a yellow compact car, possibly a Chevy Nova, which then drives away with its headlights out. Police are also looking for a black-haired man who annoyed Judy inside the club and was heard muttering that she was a snob. So now police, the Omega Force, is looking for patterns. And they hit on two. Valentina Suriani was a graduate of St. Catharines, where Judy Placido had just graduated from. Mm-hmm. Jody Valenti and Donna Loria had also been out dancing in a discotheque the night they were shot, as were Sal and Judy. All but two of the shootings occurred on the weekend. It meant the killer probably had a job. All but one took place between midnight and 3 in the morning. Eight of the 11 shooting victims were women, and all but three of the victims were shot inside parked cars. Judy Placido was in the shadow of a mental hospital, and that pushed the buttons of several detectives who were convinced that, you know, some lunatic had been looking out the window and had seen Judy, you know, perhaps sunbathing down below, and then had become fixated with her. And of course, twice now, the killers had returned to the same neighborhood, Forest Hills and Pelham Bay in the Bronx. So, I mean, the next thing that happens in New York, it doesn't have anything to do with shooting. On July 14th, during a heat wave, 9:34 p.m., the lights go out. There's a blackout in New York City. And there had been a blackout in 1965 in New York, which was remembered nostalgically. People mm-hmm. made friends. They drank in candlelit bars. It became a symbol of New York's resiliency. There was a movie and a book called Where Were You When the Lights Went Out? Right. But the 77 blackout wasn't like that at all. It was more like pouring gasoline on the fire.
Yeah.
More than 1,600 stores were looted. 1,037 fires were set. 1,700 false alarms were called in. Thousands were arrested. Cops called it the Night of the Animals. Many New Yorkers remembered a time when they were proud of being a New Yorker because New York was smart and strong and overcame hardship, but this behavior was the sign of a city of bad character, a town with a personality disorder. You know, the lower class, normally powerless, saw a way to seize power in the dark, and chaos reigned. But as far as we know, during all of that madness, the Son of Sam stayed inside. There was only one attack left. And because of what he had written in the Jimmy Breslin letter, what are you going to have for July 29th?
Yeah.
The police were convinced that the first anniversary of the Donna Loria, Jody Valenti shootings was going to be a night that he would attack. And they were out. You know, Nobody had the night off. Every cop in New York was out, and they were concentrating on the areas where they thought that the most likely to hit. And in that way, didn't happen until the next night. You know, the Omega had been covering the Bronx and Queens. Their traps were set. You know, they're ready to shout code 44. There's no way he can get away this time. Well, it turned out all the Son of Sam had to do to get away with it this time was to switch boroughs. And the next shooting occurred in the Bath Beach section of Brooklyn, South Brooklyn, 15 miles from the nearest other attack. And the closest one to where I live now. I walk by there all the time. The location was a lover's lane with the Belt Parkway on one side and a playground on the other.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. My favorite guilty pleasure entertainment is Netflix documentaries like the recent The Night Stalker. But I don't feel any guilt about how much I enjoy playing Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a unique match 3 puzzle game with thousands of levels and new content added all the time. I've only been playing a few months, and I'm already, I admit, obsessed. It was easy to learn how to play. I'm a real novice. And from the start, I found it ever-increasingly challenging and demanding and incredible fun and hard to stop playing, trying to achieve just one more level. You befriend a crazy cast of fiends to help you solve each level and defeat the slugs. I'm at level 75, and I'm determined to get more and more levels. With over 100 million downloads, this Best Fiends is a 5-star puzzle game. If you love a challenge, Best Fiend gives you 5,000 of them, with more levels and challenges added every month. I keep telling myself, just one more level. This is incredible fun. With Best Fiends, there's something new every day with literally thousands of levels to play. Plus, loads of fun characters to collect. You'll never get tired of solving puzzles with Best Fiends. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, we talked about Jimmy Breslin, and we talked about the letters that he was receiving and the what many people thought was a sort of a challenge for Son of Sam to do something, to come to fruition the things that he had said. So you talk about this last attack, and of course the police were with their trap. It wasn't effective whatsoever. So what is the next move for Jimmy Breslin and police?
Well, yeah, the last attack is the shooting of Robert Violante and Stacy Moskowitz. They're both 20 years old. They're on their first date. They went to a movie, then to a disco in Bay Ridge. It's another section of Brooklyn. And then to park. The parking area was right next to a playground. Stacy said, let's play on the swings for a little while. And they do. And there was also, there's an arcing walking bridge that goes over the expressway and to a bike path right along New York Bay. The beautiful view of, there's Coney Island on the left and the Verrazano Bridge on the right. So it's a pretty little area. But while they're playing on the swings, they walk right past a creepy guy who's sort of hanging out. He's leaning against the building that has the restrooms with his arms folded on his chest. It's hard to say exactly what made him so creepy. He was rough looking. He seemed weird. He had piercing dark eyes. He's unkempt, unshaven, grubby. And he wore a blue shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Now, it's a hot summer, so having your shirt sleeves rolled up seemed pretty normal. Mm-hmm. But Stacy says, that guy makes me nervous. So they go back to the car. And, you know, they start to get to know each other better. And the shooter strikes at 2:35 a.m. It's July 31st. I mean, technically two nights after the first shooting, but really only one because it's after midnight. And fires four times at Robert and Stacy through the open passenger window of Robert's 1969 four-door Buick Skylark. Now, the couple in the car in front of Violante's car, they're not getting along that night and have nothing better to do than to watch everybody else. So they see the shooting. They're watching when the shooting takes place. And they see the man crouching into a shooter's squat, power shooter's stance, low center of gravity, balanced, you know, taking the bulldog's kick right in the core. And after the shooting, they saw the man flee. They described him as 25 to 30 years old, stocky, last seen calmly walking away from the scene across the street and into the playground where he disappeared. Now, Stacy is shot twice in the head. One bullet merely grazed her scalp, while the other entered the left side of her head, tore a path through her brain, and came to rest at the base of her neck. Robert had been shot once, the bullet going through one eye and severely damaging the other. His ears were harmed by the explosive sound of the weapon, and for a time he could only hear a humming noise. Blacked out for a moment, he had no idea how long, but probably just a matter of seconds, he came to, and he was blind, and he could tell that he was soaked in his own blood, and he knew he was conscious because he could hear Stacy moaning.
Right.
He reached with his hands and found the car horn, which he pressed and kept pressing, and started to yell, "Help me, don't let me die." Now, Robert had been blinded. Stacy lingered in the hospital for days before she died. Now, this is not a deserted area. It's, you know, not as many people back then had air conditioning as they do now. And on a hot summer night, people stayed outside where there was at least a little bit of breeze.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the sounds of the horns and the screaming drew a crowd right away. People ran to get towels, and you know, Robert's laying on his back next to the car, and they're putting towels over his face. And a woman one street over earlier in the evening had watched as a man who didn't match the description of the man in the playground at all, who was wearing a denim jacket with the sleeves rolled down, odd attire for a night that hot, and holding one arm stiff as if he was hiding something up his sleeve, walked by. And she watched as the guy's car was ticketed for parking too close to a fire hydrant. And the man walked over to the car, pulled the ticket out from underneath the windshield wiper and threw it into the car and got into the car and drove off. So, as it happened multiple times, there had been more than one suspect seen at the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the blonde escaped in a yellow VW Volkswagen with its lights out, which makes me think it may be the same car as at the Bayside Queens shooting, where a yellow compact car, maybe a Chevy Nova, with its lights out was seen. It sounds like the same MO. You know, yellow cars driving off with their lights out doesn't happen very often. And the husky man seen by the lady walking her dog gets into a Ford Galaxy, and of course, he's been ticketed. So, as we now know, the dark-haired man was David Berkowitz.
Right.
The identity of the blind man remains officially unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And assuming that Berkowitz was part of a gang of young people passing around a 44, he was also the fall guy. He took the rap. He was arrested in possession of the 44, ballistically matched all the crimes. He did not implicate others in the crimes until after he was in prison for life. He took a crack at an insanity defense. He told police that a neighbor's dog, Sam Carr's dog, Harvey, was ordering him to kill. You know, David Berkowitz had once shot Sam Carr's dog, Harvey. Harvey survived. His apartment was found bare and well graffitied. But Berkowitz later said that he wrote crazy things on the wall only shortly before he was arrested, and took a lot of his possessions to Goodwill so that it would look more like a crazy person's apartment, setting the groundwork for an insanity defense that he didn't end up using. And when crunch time came, he pleaded guilty to all of the Son of Sam attacks. They had a special courtroom set up with three judges. They had a Kings County, Queens County, and Bronx judges so that they could take care of it all at once. And he was sentenced to, you know, many life sentences. And his guilty plea went against his defense team's wishes. They spent months trying to establish a case that Berkowitz was insane. And at the last second, Berkowitz pulls the rug out and pleads guilty. Now, he later says that he belongs to a satanic cult and that he was only the shooter in three of the Son of Sam attacks. And on July 10th, 1979, a little less than a year after the last Son of Sam attack, Berkowitz himself is attacked in his cell block, a cell block that was supposed to offer additional security for high-risk inmates. The attacker, whom Berkowitz has refused to name, used a razor to cut the left side of Berkowitz's throat, a wound that required 56 stitches to close. Now, if there wasn't already enough evidence of a conspiracy, soon after his arrest, before the trials or anything, an employee of the Mamaroneck Animal Hospital, now Mamaroneck's a town in Westchester County, north of Yonkers, mm-hmm. where Berkowitz lived, tells a reporter from the New York Daily News that on the day before Berkowitz is arrested, he and another man come into her shelter. And the two men are clearly together because they're wearing matching yellow baseball caps with Napa stitch across the front. Now, that could have signified a place in California. It could have been an auto parts store. But right. Matching hats, and they're both wearing matching jogging shoes. So they look like a team. And they looked at a German Shepherd that was available for adoption. And they talked about it for a little while. The guy who was with Berkowitz looked just like some of those Son of Sam suspect drawings. He had the dirty blonde hair parted on the side, longish. You know, police refused to speculate and assured the public that any and all friends of Berkowitz's were going to be thoroughly investigated. Well, you know, that didn't happen. The NYPD was suffering not only from having to deal with a crime-ridden New York City, but from Son of Sam burnout. I mean, they were suffering from battle fatigue. There were cops that felt like they hadn't slept, you know, during the entire year of the Son of Sam siege. And the last thing they wanted to do was investigate all of Berkowitz's friend. Berkowitz had the murder weapon for all of the crimes in his possession when he was caught. He confessed to all of the crimes. Case closed. Now, the employee at the animal house recalled that the man with Berkowitz did all of the talking. That Berkowitz just seemed like a big doofy guy and stood there and grinned, stroking the dog while his friend talked. And when the friend found out that there was a background check involved before you could adopt a dog, they said, well, I'll have to think about it, and left. This is even more interesting because bad things are happening to dogs. I mean, a dog featured in Berkowitz's attempt to create an insanity defense. He'd shot at least two dogs in addition to the young people of New York he shot. The other dog he killed, it belonged to the Nito family, and they lived on Wicker Street. You know, mm-hmm. Wicked King Wicker, good name for a book. And that was right around the corner from the car house where the dog Harvey was shot and wounded. Now, there is evidence that a systemic campaign against dogs is going on in Orange County, which is the county on the other side of the Hudson River, at the time of the Son of Sam attacks. In the Walden, New York area, 85 ginned German Shepherds and Dobermans are discovered between October 1976 and October 1977.
Wow.
Now, despite the evidence of conspiracy, you know, the NYPD is done. Abraham Beame is running for re-election. He's going to celebrate that he's, you know, was around for the solving of the Son of Sam case. The cops are doing a victory lap. There's no conspiracy. Leave us alone. And that might have been where the story would have ended if it hadn't been for a journalist by the name of Maury Terry.
What's Maury Terry's background before this? What's his journalistic background?
Well, he's an investigative journalist. He was employed and bopped from story to story. The same when he gets on this case, he really gets devoured by it. He spends pretty much the rest of his life investigating the Son of Sam conspiracy, and does some tremendous work. I mean, one of the things.
What does he find out about John Carr? We mentioned John Carr earlier.
Yeah. First of all, he's impressed by the number of eyewitnesses that said Berkowitz was not the shooter at a particular crime scene, including the last one. You know, Tommy Zaino, who's with his girlfriend, parked in the car right in front of Violente and Moskowitz's car, and sees the killer aiming the gun, firing the gun, says, no, it wasn't David Berkowitz. Now, the other thing that troubles Maury Terry is that Berkowitz, who's assumed by just about everyone to be Looney Tunes, had claimed to base his entire persona on a neighbor named Sam Carr, who's an old man that he'd never met. And the first letter in particular, you know, I'm locked into the attic by my father, Sam. My father, Sam, drinks blood. He needs to have sacrifice. But, you know, Sam is basically Satan.
Mm-hmm.
So he decides to look more into the Carr family. And he finds that, well, first of all, you can see the Carr's home from Berkowitz's apartment window. And Sam's daughter, Wheat, she'd already showed up in the story at the Yonkers police dispatcher. She was the Yonkers police dispatcher who took the NYPD call after Berkowitz's Galaxy was ticketed. Cop called and said, we're interested in a guy named David Berkowitz. And she says, hey, that's the guy we think shot our dog. He shot our dog with a .44 caliber weapon, which turned out not to be true. So, I mean, it's interesting that she made that mistake. But she was putting together Son of Sam with David Berkowitz before the New York Police Department was. Now, Terry found out that Wheat had two brothers, John and Michael. John had been in the Air Force. Michael was a freelance advertising stylist. John, Terry couldn't help but notice, had been, at the time of the Son of Sam shootings, a hippie type with stringy, dirty blonde hair. Mm-hmm. It got better. John and Michael, who were actual sons of Sam, by all accounts, you know, didn't care for their father. And John's nickname was Wheaties. John Wheaties, as mentioned in the Jimmy Breslin letter. Now, it's odd to have a nickname that mimics your sister's actual name. You know, sister's name is Wheat, and he's John Wheaties.
Yeah.
I have no explanation for that. But John Wheaties is named in the letter. It's his actual nickname. So it's got confirmation that Berkowitz doesn't just know of John Carr. He knows John Carr. He knows his nickname. Now, Terry noted that killing animals was known to provide the bloodletting at satanic masses, and that there was satanic symbolism mixed into the Son of Sam letters, as well as some of the locations of the shootings, the Eliphaz Disco in particular. Had Berkowitz been a part of a satanic cult? Well, there was more evidence that he had been. A tour of Untermeyer Park in the northern section of Yonkers, where Berkowitz lived in Westchester County, revealed graffiti indicating that it hosted satanic rituals. There were animal carcasses found in that area. Upside-down crosses. Pentagrams had been spray-painted onto concrete surfaces there. So, Terry investigates John Carr. So next stop, let's talk to John Wheaties, because it's starting to look like he might be onto something here. Now, unfortunately for his investigation, by the time, and it's autumn of 1978 at this point, by the time he starts looking for John Wheaties is dead. He finds out that from 1972 to 76, John Carr was stationed in North Dakota. In 1976, the year that the Son of Sam attacks began, John Carr was discharged from the Air Force, allegedly because of drug addiction. He was said to have been in New York for many of the Son of Sam attacks and greatly resembled the hippie with stringy hair seen at some of the attacks. And he's 30 years old at this point, which would also fit in with the description. We're not dealing with a kid. In January 1978, he called his girlfriend in North Dakota complaining that the police were after him, although he didn't say why. And as far as we know, the police were not after him. So why was he feeling paranoid? In the fall of 1978, just around the time when Maury Terry decides to go looking for him, he returns to North Dakota, and he's only there for 2 days when he's found shot in the head. And written near the body was, in blood, was 666, number of the beast, and SSNYC, which could have meant Son of Sam, New York City. Now, the SSNYC is written on the wall, and the 666 is written on John Carr's hand. Now, the death is ruled a suicide, which leaves open the question of who wrote the messages in his blood. But however that happened, John Carr has met his end, and Terry is now convinced that Berkowitz and John Carr were part of a satanic cult that had read the satanic teachings of devil worshiper Aleister Crowley. Mm-hmm. So Terry turns his attention to Michael Carr. He learned that in 1975, the year before the Sam shooting started, before Berkowitz moved to the apartment house that looked down on the Carr house, he was living in an apartment on Barnes Avenue in the Bronx. He met Michael Carr, and he's got corroboration for this. And Michael Carr is known as an occult-obsessed drug addict, a Satan worshiper. Mm-hmm. Michael Carr invites Berkowitz to a party where Berkowitz meets members of a witch's coven, one to which Michael Carr belongs. Apparently he considers himself a warlock. And these were the 22 disciples of hell referred to in the Breslin letter.
Right.
Again, you have human intelligence matching up with things that are written in the letters by the Son of Sam. And we're heading down the rabbit hole now. Terry comes to believe that it's because of Berkowitz's friendship with Michael Carr that he moves to an apartment only 200 yards from the Carr home in Yonkers. Terry's next order of business is to interview Michael Carr, but again, he's too late. On October 4th, 1979, Michael Carr is killed in a one-car accident when he hit a street lamp at 75 miles per hour. There are no skid marks, and Michael's sister, Wheat, insists that he was killed, that he was run off the road by another car. That's, C-A-R. From there, Terry's conspiracy theory becomes expansive. He goes coast to coast, includes affiliations with long-standing and well-funded organizations, such as the Process Church, which is a spinoff of Scientology, and includes among its members Bruce Davis, who is still in prison for killing Gary Hinman as part of the Manson family.
Right.
The Son of Sam killings were not just a serial killer out doing his thing, but they were a terror campaign designed to bring about a social Armageddon. And boy, it came close to working. If it hadn't been for Berkowitz's traffic ticket for parking next to a fire hydrant, there's no telling how long it would have gone on and what damage it would have done to the city of New York.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. You talked about that this group of terrorists, satanic terrorists, or influenced terrorists, came to an end with Berkowitz. But you talk about also Terry claiming that Berkowitz spoke of the Arliss Perry murder. Now, the Arliss Perry murder is something that he shouldn't have known or couldn't have known. So tell us about why Terry thought that this was very important.
Well, it's interesting to me because Arliss Perry is a murder that is included in my previous book, The Age of Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
Arliss Perry was the beautiful new bride attending Stanford University. She had just had an argument with her husband, nothing serious, and had gone to the Stanford University Cathedral to pray, which was not unusual for her. And she didn't come home that night. And she was found between the pews, you know, horribly violated with church candles in what appeared to be a ritualistic murder. Now, David Berkowitz, in one of his first interviews with Maury Terry, says that he should look into that and gives him some details about it, which leads to the obvious conclusion that Berkowitz is in touch with somebody in prison who knows about the epidemic of weird and horrible murders taking place in Northern California during the 1969 and the early part of 1970s. In reality, I wrote the Wicked King Wicker before I wrote The Age of Zodiac. They're released in opposite directions for reasons that probably aren't that interesting. For a while, I wanted to release the Wicked King Wicker with an academic press, and eventually decided against it. But it moved the books out of order. And there are certainly a lot of connections between Zodiac and Son of Sam, even without Berkowitz talking about Arliss Perry in prison to an investigative journalist. The Zodiac killer was in Northern California, killed between 1960 and 1970, theorized that there was a team of killers using the Zodiac as an avatar to take the credit for them all.
Right, right.
Which is considered controversial, even though with Son of Sam, that's exactly what happened. This is Son of Sam is not David Berkowitz. The Son of Sam is these people who may or may not be associated with the Process Church, who were taking turns using the same weapon and going out in packs looking for victims. Now, the Son of Sam attacks seem to be imitative in some ways to the Zodiac. Zodiac certainly seems to have provided a template. There's a gunman firing into parked cars containing two young people making out. Both feature terrifying letters sent both to local newspapers and left at crime scenes. Both attacked in areas where young people tended to feel safe. But there are differences as well. I mean, Zodiac killed with a variety of guns and a knife. Now, there's more reason to think that the Zodiac's more than one person than Son of Sam. Son of Sam cases all featured the same weapon. Zodiac seemed dyslexic and liked coded messages, while the Son of Sam knew the proper use of a semicolon and could be highly poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the biggest difference of all is, you know, the Zodiac case never resulted in an arrest, and the letters from the Zodiac continued for years after the last known Zodiac murder. And among the crimes that seem to have come out of that rash of murders started by the Zodiac is the murder of Arliss Perry. And here's David Berkowitz talking about it to an investigative reporter after being arrested for the Son of Sam killings.
You talk about that there was, you had just mentioned it, alluded to it, that there was clear difference when people read those letters, that there was a extreme chasm of intelligence between the two letter writers, which would give credence that there was, it wasn't just David Berkowitz involved.
Well, right, and we have letters that we know Berkowitz wrote, which seem like cheap imitations of the masterpiece that begins "Hello from the gutters of New York City."
Mm-hmm.
And also the letters, and both the Borelli letter and the Breslin letter are in almost a font like handwriting. They're printed in all capital letters, so neatly that for a time, letterers for comic books were under suspicion by, you know, a desperate police force.
Wow.
But, you know, if Berkowitz has ever been asked to, you know, write me something in that font, you know, I don't know about it because I don't think he can. I'm pretty sure there's this conclusive proof that, you know, Berkowitz not only wasn't even just taking this, you know, dictation, he didn't write the letters.
You talk also, about... Sorry, go ahead.
That's good. No, go ahead.
You wrote as well, it was very interesting, that Berkowitz told Maury Terry that he only killed Donna Loria and Esau and Valentina Serrani, and that the Bath shootings took place under a street lamp because it was being filmed by a snuff film crew.
Oh boy!
And then you have your. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, for years, I thought that it was nonsense to think that a snuff film was being made in Bath Beach. Basically, because what would you see? I mean, there's supposedly someone with a movie camera in a nearby van. What would you see? You would see a man firing a gun into a car. But the money shot is the victims, and they're inside the car. The camera would have to be inside the car. And maybe I'm not thinking it through properly, but it seemed to me like a snuff film would have as its center of attention the victim.
Mm-hmm.
It's the snuff. The snuff is the money shot. You know, sort of like a Black Dahlia scenario. But then, you know, it occurred to me that at that point, the Son of Sam shootings were so notorious and so famous, so you know, the Hollywood hot even, that a shooting that showed someone firing into Robert Violante's car would be worth, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on that kind of deviant market. So I think it's more feasible now than I did for many years. But I don't know. I don't know much about the snuff film market. I know that it probably is even further underground than, you know, child pornography. And I'm sure the people who are into that sort of thing know how to keep secrets and know each other because they need to share and swap. But, the guy who was supposed to be directing the movie was a producer named Roy Radin. And we do know that Roy Radin was himself murdered and found partially buried in the desert in California by a man who went to prison for the murder named William Mensah, who's referred to as Manson 2 in Maury Terry's book, which is long since out of print. But an interesting note, William Mensah, the killer of Roy Radin, snuff filmmaker, alleged snuff filmmaker, was also alone with one of Carole King's husbands at the time that Carole King's husband died of a drug overdose. So, I mean, these aren't nice guys. And
no.
I mean, they're into some really scary stuff. And I know that, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe has been mentioned as a person who was into this stuff. And you don't know what to believe and what not to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that the argument that, you know, Weir murders stopped when Berkowitz was arrested in the New York area is not true. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no more 44 murders because the police had the gun. But there is the horrible murder of Howard Green, who's 51 years old, and Carole Myron, 33, mm-hmm. in Brooklyn. And they were found, you know, murdered in a ritualistic way. Their eyeballs had been blown out. The tips of their ears were cut off. They had almost all of their blood drained through approximately 30 puncture marks made in identical places on the two bodies. The two corpses were bound in canvas and rugs and dumped. They were dumped in West Paterson, New Jersey. And you know, nothing good ever happens in West Paterson, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And they were discovered by a boy walking his dog. So, I mean, if they lived on DeKalb Avenue here in Brooklyn, right where the last Son of Sam attack took place. So the creepy kids stopped passing around the 44, but it doesn't mean they stopped doing creepy things.
Yeah. In this incredible book, you also, and we didn't have time to talk about it, was the kind of a wild trial in that his disposition changes dramatically at different times in the courtroom. He's very passive and sits there smiling and quiet, but there is a time when he goes berserk in court, doesn't he?
Horrifying. Horrifying. He starts to scream at poor Stacy Moskowitz's mother. You know, Stacy was a whore. Stacy was a whore. Kill him so badly that they're getting up from their seat and moving to the aisle, and the security's all over the place, grabbing people and separating people. It's just a tremendous scene from a guy who, since he was arrested, had been scaring people with his calmness and his little shy smile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the FBI says that that serial killers tend to be adopted. That's Berkowitz. Berkowitz was adopted by the Nat and Pearl Berkowitz because his actual mother had a boyfriend who didn't want a baby in the house, so he was given away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, had a girl-hating club when he was a little boy, like in the Little Rascals. So he's
and
not
did a stuck, stint in the army.
Not alone,
did a stint in the army as well.
He did, and he was in Korea. And one of the Carr brothers, John Carr, I think, was stationed in Korea at the same time. No evidence they knew each other, but they could have. And Berkowitz took a lot of LSD while he was in the army and sort of went from a gung-ho soldier to being a psychobabble hippie overnight. And by the time he was discharged and came back home, his old friends didn't want to talk to him anymore. They did, you know, he was too odd.
Yeah. I want to thank much.
I'm glad I have published the Wicked King Wicker. It's been something that in many ways I've been working on since I was in college. And I was never satisfied with Jimmy Breslin's book. I thought it, you know, kind of missed the mark. Like Spike Lee's movie kind of missed. Maury Terry's book's been out of print for a long time. You know, I thought a book that really captured the psychology of fear that this pack of weirdos, you know, brought down on New York City, a New York City that really deserved better. It's a miracle that New York recovered and became, you know, safe again after all of that, but it did.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I want to thank you so much for this remarkable interview, talking about the Wicked King Wicker, the son of Sam siege upon New York. It's been an absolute pleasure, Michael. For those who want to find out more about this book, you have an Amazon page, website? Tell us.
I do. Amazon.com. I'm the Michael Benson with the white beard. You can't miss
me.
There
we go. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks a lot.
This has been a pleasure. The Wicked King Wicker. Incredible story of Son of Sam. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks, man.
Hope to speak to you again soon. Good night.
Yes. Good night.